You are listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. This talk was given at 3800 Marlton Pike. For more information, check out circleofhope.net or join us in person on Sunday at 10:30 a.m. or 7 p.m.
So I was at an ophthalmologist appointment and a couple weeks ago. It was right before the Super Bowl, so it was super easy to talk to everyone. You know, it was a super beautiful moment in history. And I was talking to this guy who was even more of a conversationalist than I am. And he was super open about his whole life. And in a few minutes, I knew that he was divorced and he had a custody battle with his ex-wife who had taken his 12-year-old son to Florida. And I was really feeling for the guy. He was suffering. And who better to tell about it than the stranger sitting next to you in the ophthalmologist office? At my ophthalmologist office, they put you in a darkened room after they dilate your eyes. You guys go to the ophthalmologist ever? I go to the ophthalmologist all the time now because I have an infection in my eye. And they dilate your eyes and they put you in this dark room. And I'm sitting in there talking to him about his suffering and what's going on. My friend and I were sitting there talking about Eagles, divorce, and, you know, of course, the nature of the universe. Because my friend took it to karma. He wished karma on his mean ex-wife. I hope she gets what's coming to her. Don't let the karma hit you out on the door. And then he said a bad word. I asked him about karma and wasn't sure, but I hoped that it was, he hoped that it was real because he wanted her to be punished for what she had done to him. And I agreed that it sounded like, from his perspective, she had indeed done him wrong. Of course, in my 7-minute conversation, I didn't get all the truth. But then I hoped out loud that karma was a lie. I didn't tell him, because, you know, I don't have any authority for him, but I said, I sure hope karma's not true. Too many really bad people don't get nearly enough justice, and too many much less bad people get way too much justice, and it doesn't add up. And everyone knows this, but for some reason there's this lasting comfort in this idea of karma. We'd rather maintain some sense of control about our destiny. We'd rather know what's coming. We'd rather believe that some good will come our way because we deserve it. And if we can't get that, we'll take some bad because we deserve it, because at least then we know that we made a difference in our own lives. If what happens to us is what we deserve, then it means that I have some power in what's going to happen to me, and that feels good. I understand that. But I think I got to him a little bit, my friend, the Eagles fan and the divorcee, when I told him that I didn't want karma to be true because I have not suffered for every one of my mistakes. The wrongs I have done have not all come back to haunt me. And if they're just like on a longer cycle, spinning out there in orbit and inevitably coming back on their cycle to crash into me, I'm in trouble. So karma doesn't give me comfort, if I'm honest about it. Jesus never talked about karma. Surprise. An idea that was very foreign to him, across the world to him. But in a way he did in John 9, the story that I'm stuck on for all of Lent. Because Jesus totally obliterates karma in this story. Why was this man born blind? The disciples asked Jesus. And Jesus answered, it wasn't because of anybody's sin. It was so that the work of God could be made manifest in him. That little sentence, it wasn't because of sin, it was so the work of God could be made manifest in him, is worth 40 days of meditation. I still don't know what it means, but I'm getting at it. I know what it doesn't mean now. I'm to the point where I know what it doesn't mean, but I think I have further to go to understanding the mystery of what it does mean. What happens to us isn't, this is the doesn't, this is what it doesn't mean. What happens to us isn't a matter of what we deserve, but instead it is a matter of what God is doing. God is doing something new and unexpected every time, and I still don't get that yet. So I want you to meditate on it with me. Let me just run through the story and catch everybody up. Here's a picture for you to look at that I think is beautiful, of Jesus touching a blind man. This is actually a different blind man. The artist, this is of one in Mark, but don't worry about that. Jesus is walking along, and he sees this blind man on the side of the road, presumably begging, but who knows what he's doing. The important part is that Jesus notices him. The disciples must know this guy or know about this guy because they know that he was born blind. Or maybe they stop to talk to him first and that part of the story isn't recorded. And they ask, Hey Jesus, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind? Why would something like this happen, being born blind? He has a tough life. Jesus answers in his karma-killing way, and then he heals the guy by spitting in the dirt and rubbing mud in the man's eyes and sending him off to wash at a pool called Siloam. After he's healed, his neighbors can't believe it. Is this the guy? They wonder if there's some kind of imposter thing going on, like he's always had a twin brother or something. He insists that he is indeed himself, and that it was Jesus who healed him. But it was on the Sabbath, the Jewish day of rest when you're not supposed to do anything. So they take him to the religious people who grill him about who he is and what happened. They even bring in his parents to verify his identity. And his parents say, hey, don't get on our case. He's the one who got healed. Talk to him. These religious people have it out with the man about who healed him because it can't be Jesus. Because Jesus is a sinner, for one, because he just healed someone on the Sabbath, apparently. That's a no-no. But two, we also know about Jesus, and that dude's a sinner. Okay? I know Jesus. He's bad news. This is the religious people's perspective. They have it out for Jesus. But the man sees through their disbelief, and he urges them to believe that Jesus is from God. It's a fascinating little conversation that they have, one of the longer conversations recorded in the New Testament, where they do this back and forth. He said, hey, man, I only know what I've experienced. Jesus healed me. If you're saying he's a sinner, I don't know what a sinner is, because how did he heal me then? You know, it's this great little conversation. I encourage you to read it. We're not going to read it this week, the exact text. So then after everything, they let him go. Thankfully, he doesn't get in trouble for being healed. But they let him go, and Jesus comes to find him. I like that part. Jesus goes to find him, and he tells the man who he is, and the man wants to follow him. He says, I'm the Son of God, essentially. He asks him, do you want to know the Son of God? And the man who was born blind, and that's all we know him as, says, yes, who is he? And Jesus says, this guy, essentially. But you're talking to him. You're talking to him, and the man worships him. The last thing that Jesus says to the man in their conversation is, I entered this world to render judgment, to give sight to the blind, and to show those who think they see that they are blind. The religious people in this story cannot understand that they are blind. They can't accept it. They know what they deserve. They know what this man deserves. Despite all the evidence to the contrary, they demand belief. They demand belief that God is watching out for them in a special way. No, 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 no. God can't be for this guy because he's for us. It's a little bit karmic, you know? God's going to give us good stuff because we did the right thing. This way of seeing excludes anything like an undeserved miracle for this man who's obviously a sinner because he was born blind. You see how this whole logic works out? It just keeps kind of getting circular on them. We know nothing about this man and what he did. We only hear a disavowal from Jesus about why this man was suffering. The religious people can't accept this miracle. They can't accept the miracle because I think they have these foregone conclusions. They have these judgments that are set in stone. The word conclusion, though, is my favorite way to think about it, because these religious people think they see the world completely. They have concluded their investigation of everything. And of course, this is an oversimplification. There's plenty of mystery, even at that time, in the Jewish faith. But as far as like these Pharisees, they thought they had it figured out. That's the type of Jewish sect that is being represented here. They thought they had figured it all out. And they conclude. You know, they make a decision. They make a judgment. But conclusion, of course, also has this sense of finality. Concluding is ending, cutting off the story, assuming it's over. You know, like walking out of Black Panther before the last two scenes that happened during the credits. Okay? Dan's the only one that saw Black Panther? Oh, really? Well, there are credit scenes. Don't leave. The second one, maybe not worth it, but the first one, definitely important. So finishing something for themselves when in fact it might not yet be over. That's what they're concluding. So the religious people's conclusions. Here they are. David, for some reason, it doesn't want to give me power. There we go. Who? What does that say? We are who we are. Blind people stay blind. I mean, that's a pretty universal understanding. I think most of us have that conclusion, you know? We might have even prayed for someone who was blind and didn't they didn't get healed. So we even have our own experience to back it up. But this man is who he is. There's no other hope for him, no other future for him. He can't change. Jesus kind of blows that up, does something really special. Here's another conclusion. God is in charge of every little thing. This man is blind because God, in his infinite wisdom, decided that he would be blind. We can't understand God's reasons, but there is comfort in that conclusion because God is in control. If God is in control, then it means the bad stuff, he's in charge of the bad stuff as well as the good stuff. This is this kind of similar to karma idea that God's in control and there's no way to really understand it, so just accept your fate. It's just kind of fatalistic. This is who you are. And also, you are who you are because God wants you to be that way. It's this kind of final. It's over. Nothing's going to change. That one's a little bit easier to get into for us because, you know, not all of us are blind. We can't understand that kind of thing. But all of us have this kind of judgment machine that gets going in us. And we might have been taught about this kind of understanding of God that was precisely defining all of the struggles that we were going to have. He's the author of our trials and then also the author of our trials being over. That's hard to understand. I mean, honestly, that it's not totally satisfying to me. I don't have a super great alternative except for what Jesus is saying here. But that doesn't totally work for me. If it works for you, tell me about it, okay? I want to know. Lots of people believe that. The other thing, Jesus doesn't fit. Jesus is a charlatan. He's a sinner. He does all the wrong things. He's from the wrong place. He's not part of our tribe, like the smaller tribe within the tribe. He's on the wrong side. He hangs out with the wrong people. God is only God if by my rules. They've set up this whole idea about who God is based on their understanding. And most of who God is dependent upon what they do. And so they can't accept something new. Last one, and this is true for everyone. If we're wrong, then we have to change. That's a conclusion. That's a universal conclusion. If I'm wrong about the way I see the universe, then I have to change. And changing is hard, and I don't want to do it. I already spent a lot of time arriving at this conclusion. This conclusion was a hard-won conclusion. And that's not even if I did it like very consciously. Like where I land right now is the product of like everything that happened to me up to this point. And you want me to change my mind? I'm 35 years old. No, that's a lot of work to reverse that kind of history, to change the way I think. No, that's too much. I feel for the religious people in that. They're just doing what they've been taught, living the best they can with the stories they've been given. That's what people do. That's what I do. There are any number of scripts that I'm stuck in right now. Jesus coming along, seeing me, is a new story called Good News, the Gospel. It's almost impossible to receive that story. And Jesus knows it. In Matthew 13, verses 12 and 13, he says this, "To those who listen to my teaching, more understanding will be given, and they will have an abundance of knowledge. But for those who are not listening, even what little understanding they have will be taken away from them. That is why I use these parables, for they look, but they don't really see. They hear, but they don't really listen or understand." Jesus' project often is kind of helping people understand where they are on this kind of continuum. I mean, it's actually a little bit more black and white. Do you get me or not? And what I say feel like the words of life to you? Or does it feel like something I need to reject? How am I striking you? Jesus is putting himself right there at the center of their decision, saying, "What do you think of me? I'm saying things that are outrageous in these parables. I'm deliberately saying things that are not answering all of your questions. Do you want more or are you done with me?" That's Jesus' project. Putting Jesus right in the center is our project for Lent. It's our purpose. We need a lengthened out season for really seeing and really understanding, for receiving this new teaching again from Jesus, for seeing him for who he really is. Hey, this is what I'm saying. Are you listening? I don't know. Honestly, I don't know if I'm listening all the time. So I'm glad to have a community where we gather around and try to listen. We don't even know. We disagree. All of us. about a lot of things. And we certainly disagree with all the rest of the church. It's not like Jesus, you know, figured this all out for us. And I think that was his idea. He wanted us to keep working with it. He wanted him to act. His presence is essential for this process. It is not a cookie cutter thing. It doesn't work without him. And he set it up that way. You can't understand a parable of Jesus without Jesus. That's his idea. So this man was blind, and now he can see. So Jesus must not be a sinner. That doesn't fit. Doesn't fit for what they're working with. And you can see how whatever you're working with, you have things that just won't fit in. And maybe some of those things are what Jesus says. Lent is a time to recognize that and to work on those things. It's a time to practice together. It's going to the gym and saying, this is who I want to be. This is my purpose. This is where I'm headed. How can I continue to make that more true? So here's a story from my life that I hope can help you get you into this story yourself about conclusions that are premature and things happening that were unexpected. In the summer of my 18th year, I got baptized and decided to really follow Jesus, to really listen to what he was saying and try to understand it. It was something I had always planned on doing, but I was kind of ambivalent about for most of my teenage years. But then I decided to go off to Christian college, and I worked on what following Jesus really meant. I had a lot of zeal. I was changing lots of stuff. And one of the things that I concluded was that I could not be in a relationship with my non-Christian girlfriend. I was painfully certain of this in a way that only an 18-year-old can be certain about anything. I went to see her at her college dorm during Lent, like a week after Valentine's Day, and I broke up with her. And I was just so convicted about it. Unless I broke up with her, I was disobeying. She came to my college dorm a couple weeks later, or maybe just a week later, to try to convince me otherwise. And we sat on the lounge because it was Wednesday, and the girls weren't allowed in the boys' hall on Wednesdays. That was the kind of place that I grew up. Kristen went to Christian college, she knows. And I read, you know, this incredibly painful moment is like happening in public. I remember someone walked by and said, "It's Wednesday and everybody's having a moment." I was having a moment. This is one of the hardest things I'd ever done, but also one of the worst things I've ever done, I think, because I decided I just needed to read her 2 Corinthians 6:14. "Do not be yoked together with unbelievers. For what do righteous and wickedness have in common? Or what fellowship can light have with darkness?" It was brutal. I mean, you're laughing, but I'm about to cry. Her mom was waiting in the parking lot, and I watched from afar as Gwyneth returned to the car. Her mom must have said something like, "What happened?" Or "What did he say?" I saw her head move. And Gwyneth just shook her head. "No." Tearfully, "No. It was over." Gets me. But Gwyneth is my wife now. She can't be here today because she's at a birthday party and 2-year-old suck at anything afternoon. She told me not to tell you how dramatic it was when we got back together, but it's notebook level good. I'll tell you another time. She told me not to... Oh, no, that's what I just said. 4 months later... We were back together, and this new decision was marked by so much gray, where the original decision was just black and white. The problem was, I still kind of believed that black and white. I still kind of believed 2 Corinthians 6:14, and I didn't know what I was doing anymore. I told her when we got back together that night, I said, "I don't know if what we're doing is right, but I want to be with you, and I love you." Rather than just cutting her out of my life, I set out to include her in the new life that I was starting on. It was the beginning of a 2-year conversation about faith and Jesus that continued even via letter when I went to live in Mexico for a year. And while I was away through participating in Circle of Hope's meetings on 10th Street in Philadelphia, Gwyneth was moved by the Holy Spirit to become a Christian. It's amazing how our lives happened, and God shows up in all kinds of ways we don't expect. Jesus was shocking the religious people in John 9. He was shocking to me when I was a young man sorting through this relationship with my eventual wife. He's still surprising to me right now. I think the way we can like lose our judgment that rules out all of that surprise is to stubbornly expect life where there is none. To look at the dead things and imagine they might be new. When you're ready to say it's over, to say yes instead of no. To keep moving rather than getting still. The air around us can be moved through. We can change. The dust that settles on us is not cement. What I learned from my experience with Gwyneth is that conclusions are not always the end. The religious people in John 9 had conclusions that were blown to bits by Jesus' healing this man born blind on the Sabbath. But they couldn't receive the new beginnings that Jesus was making. What new beginnings is Jesus making now that we are capable of seeing because we have already judged them impossible? Let me say that again. What new beginnings is Jesus making now that we are incapable of seeing because we have already judged them to be impossible? I think there are a lot. But God is always doing something impossible. And sometimes we don't think that's right. We don't think it's right that God should do something impossible. We're prejudiced. That word means we prejudge. Before something happens, we've already judged it out of existence. We rule it out. We blind ourselves to it. The remedy for this judgment, I believe, is curiosity. Expectation of the things we don't expect. Wonder about the things that we're right about. The religious leaders knew they were right about Jesus and the man he healed. I knew I was right about Gwyneth. Being right is the sort of judgment that precludes anything outside of the norm. Jesus' judgment, though, is different. Judgment day is coming. The day when Jesus will return and make things right. Jesus is righteousness. And he is going to make that our reality someday soon. Put an end to all of our suffering, all our trials, soon be over. But that judgment day in the Bible, it's often called the day of the Lord. It's all about revelation. New things being made clear. A new reality that already exists, but that we can't see. An uncovering. You know that word apocalypse? It means to uncover. That's a tray, like when you're doing the happy dance, right? That's what it looks like. Our goal, our end, is decided by Jesus. You know that sense of the word end? This is a nice little thing the English language does for us too here. Okay, have your conclusions, but the end for which you are designed, has not yet come. You know that saying, the ends justifies the means? However you get it done, as long as the goal gets met. Our goal, our end, is decided by Jesus, not by us. Our end, what we're made for, our purpose, is revelation. It's an uncovering of a new thing. You are a thing that will be uncovered. You're more beautiful than you already are. You're more aware of that reality than you already are, and that will be uncovered. In the meantime, it's a group project. Our conclusions might not be correct. We live in the wondering zone. It's not a time to say it's all figured out. Jesus will decide when that time is going to come. For now, we receive all the new revelations we can, and when there's a period, you know, we add the little squiggly on top. But G.K. Chesterton adds a nice little word of warning here at the end. Essentially, I'm advocating an open mind about spiritual things, about your life, about what anything means at all. The point of having an open mind, like having an open mouth, is to close it on something solid. G.K. Chesterton's real clever like that. If you've never read Orthodoxy, it's full of one-liners like that. Jesus is, though, our something solid. Jesus is here now with us, and he will have to be actually solid for us to safely do this project of discovery. Jesus is alive among us now. The Holy Spirit is guiding us now. And this must be true in some kind of concrete way. That's why we're looking at a magic eye book. You know, we need something beyond what is normally seen. And Jesus is it. It's not going to be as easy. Like, it's not going to be as easy as the magic eye. Or last week, Matt had us looking in our peripheral vision. Jesus is going to have to actually be here. And he is. He's going to make something new. And when he concludes time, when he ends the world as we know it, it's the end of the world as we know it, that's going to happen. It's actually a new beginning, the beginning of a new heaven and a new earth.
Thanks for listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. If you want to talk about it or get connected to a cell, you can find one under our Connect drop-down at circleofhope.net.